Ken Forrester, Executive Director at Momenta. Welcome to our Digital Thread podcast, produced by, for, and about digital industry leaders. In this series of conversations, we capture insights from the best and brightest minds in digital industry. They're executives, entrepreneurs, advisors, and other thought leaders. What they have in common is, like our team at Momenta, they are deep industry operators. We hope you find these podcasts informative. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Good day and welcome to episode 213 of Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. Today, I'm pleased to host Ryan Kuhlenbeck, co-founder and CEO, Pico MES, a startup fundamentally changing small and medium-sized manufacturing in the U.S. Pico MES is Momenta's most recent investment. As co-founder and CEO, Ryan leads the Pico team in their relentless pursuit of making the day-to-day better for manufacturers. He grew up in a factory town and started his career at General Motors. After working for startup manufacturers, including Tesla, he joined Alta Motors, a startup building a revolutionary and widely acclaimed electric motorcycle. During those experiences, he learned the importance of manufacturing execution systems, and the idea for Pico was born. He's a graduate of Missouri Science and Technology and now resides in a small factory town. Ryan, welcome to our Digital Thread podcast.
Thank you so much, Ken, for having me on. Very much looking forward to the conversation.
As well. And so, you know, we call this the Digital Thread podcast. And so we always like to start by asking our people, what would you consider to be your digital thread? In other words, the one or more thematic threads that define your digital industry journey.
Yeah, well, as you kind of went through the highlight reel of where my career has taken me, I think the automotive industry has been kind of the source of my thread, starting with General Motors and slowly working my way down to smaller and smaller sizes of factories. What I think has really guided my journey has been this concept of large companies have to work in partnership with thousands of suppliers that are much smaller than them in order to be successful. And so, you know, starting in the Midwest and kind of growing up in that factory town that you mentioned, which is where the Firestone tire was created, that the Ford Explorer, if you remember that from back in the days, that was where I grew up. And so as we've kind of lived that experience and what happened in that supplier to OEM relationship, worked for General Motors on countless, I think over a dozen different launch teams, different products of their portfolio, spent time at Tesla, as you mentioned, in the early days through the Model S launch. And then had a really awesome opportunity with Alta Motors building motorcycles. No matter how cool the concept we could come up with for a vehicle or a new engine or whatever it might be, we were always limited to what we could do with our suppliers. And so to me, this digital thread is not only about what each individual factory can achieve and how efficient they can run and how well their operations can perform over time and the business being viable, but it's this kind of one step above where we take a look at how does that play into the bigger picture of a supply chain, at least in these complicated industries, and how do we make the entire thing successful more so than just any one discrete component within it. So throughout all of these experiences, I think I've focused on, at least most recently, on this kind of thriving supply chain concept, and that led myself and two co-founders to do a silly thing and go form a company that we lovingly call Pico to try to do something about it. So to try to bring some of these, enterprise-grade solutions into that small and mid-sized factory. And then, as you mentioned recently, my wife and I made the decision, we moved out of California and back to the Midwest to our roots to be closer to those factory towns and to raise our family. So
I think it's a great story. And I also love the fact that you kind of bookend it with life in a small factory town. So I'm curious, to what degree has this life in a small factory town shaped your direction and really your perspective of the opportunity for small and medium manufacturers in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to believe that all of the experiences have had equal weighting, but I feel like growing up in the small town, you realize the importance of stable work in people's lives. Like, we have a very people-centric approach to the way my business runs today. And I think it comes from my friends being in factories, and you see what happens in the late 90s and the early 2000s when everything went overseas in this area anyway, and what it did to people's lives. and the new reshoring initiatives, or just honestly, it's the ability for technology to enable local supply in general. That's just a theme that integrates significantly with my experiences of the past. The other side of it, if you think about it, over half the output of U.S. manufacturing comes from small and mid-sized factories, 500 people or less. Doesn't mean they can't have big names on the doors, but they operate as smaller facilities. And these are the places that sponsor the T-ball league, right? Like, they are the ones that ensure the local restaurants have people going to them at lunch, right? It has a community impact that I think sometimes can be overlooked. And having that background and growing up in that area is something that is just front and center to me. Very passionate about skilled trades, for example. You think about the demand for CNC operators that exist right now, people that can handle these digital technologies, robotics programmers. But growing up where I grew up, if you went into the vocational track in high school, you were looked down upon. I'm 43 years old as of yesterday. If I wanted to take a shop class, that was not a path forward to what I think a lot of the perspectives were at the time. And now you look at those that are some of the most in-demand jobs and best career paths that are out there. And so this perspective of kind of where I grow up, I think keeps me grounded in a lot of ways, focused on, it's not just about building business, it's about impacting people's lives.
Well said, actually. And by the way, happy belated birthday. So, I wish I was 43 again. Wow.
Yeah, I have a 2-year-old running around, so that late life start keeps you younger than you want to be. I'll put it that way.
Yeah,
or older, depending on the day.
So you've had over 15 years of tenure in the automotive manufacturing space. General Motors, Seekant, Tesla, Tola, Alta Motors. What originally attracted you to this space?
I think ever since I was a young kid, I've loved mechanical things. My dad's an electrical engineer. We don't hold that against him over here in the mechanical engineering side. But I've been into hot rods since I was very young. My first hot rod with a friend of mine was a 66 Plymouth Satellite when I was 13. So, and then have just been building hot rods ever since. So there's what I love about the automotive industry is it's one of the most complicated integration paths out there, right? Aerospace and automotive have to bring together thousands of pieces that all have to arrive at the exact same moment with perfect quality, or else, 3,000 people twiddle their thumbs for the day. And I think that complicated integration is just captivating to me. And when you combine that with a product that people personally associate themselves with, it's like their brand is tied to the vehicles that they drive. I just think that's a really awesome industry to be involved with. So definitely a lot of passion behind there.
I can sense that. And I like that the kind of the complex systems converge on something that's relevant and meaningful to, individuals as well. I just wonder if people are branding themselves Lyft and Uber these days, Ford and Chevy.
You're still branding yourself, right? A Toyota Camry, sometimes the brand is that you don't care about the car that you drive. Yeah. And, the 69 Camaros that I built with a really close friend of mine, you're selling a very different brand in that world. Yep. So,
Well, there's a lot of people interesting branding themselves as Tesla these days. So,
Absolutely.
Well, I think you've already done a good job of laying the foundation here, but tell us about the origin story for Pico MES, which you co-founded in 2019.
That's right. So, in 2015, I had the opportunity to move to Alta Motors, and we had to, in order to be successful building an electric dirt bike, weight, performance, technology was just top of mind. And so we needed the ability to manufacture the product near where the design team was so that we could iterate rapidly, right? We couldn't have a disconnect between manufacturing and design that held up the ability to bring the latest inverter technology or to take 10% mass out of the battery pack. But the counter to that was we were creating a factory in the highest labor rate, highest cost of labor in the country, right? Starting wages were $30 an hour for labor in San Francisco. Facilities were extremely expensive, $2 per square foot per month. So in order to be successful, we knew we had to kind of do something a little bit different. And after 15 years at the time in the auto industry, I'd seen big company solutions. We had pioneered a lot of really awesome solutions at Tesla. Like, I think we were ready to try something different. And we had this opportunity. Alta Motors did some really neat stuff. Some of it is kind of interesting when it comes to the Pico story. But what it really did more than anything else was it made it possible that better solutions were out there for small and mid-sized factories than the legacy solutions that were available at the time. Right, the current solution sets out there required consultants that were really expensive, and you had to hand over the facility effectively to somebody else who was setting up routings, for example, you know, the station to station to station flow that occurs throughout the factory. That was all coded in the background. And I just don't think a small and mid-sized factory can be successful when a third party is responsible for a portion of the day-to-day operations. So as Altimotors got in bed with, you know, Harley-Davidson and things went sideways in that relationship, it became pretty obvious there was two choices, right? There was go to another factory and use another solution that wasn't very effective and have to fight through that battle, or take the learnings that we had from the previous years and go out and do something about it. And we took the plunge. I would, you know, it's one of the hardest, arguably dumbest things that I've ever done in my life. And we've been on the journey with Pico helping small factories ever since.
Well, I love the fact you admit the potential dumbness of it, but I don't remember in the pitch to us that you ever used any term except smart, smart investment, smart ideas, everything else. So now reality comes out. Having done a number of startups myself, I can tell you that I always hit that point of, was this smart or was this stupid? But, you know, you go back to the road less traveled, right, as a life mantra, and just say, you know, even if it was, look at the experiences I built up and the networks. And you only know at the end of your life how that gave you opportunities to do even greater things later, right? So obviously we're investors, so we're counting on the fact you will be successful and you'll look back and say, this is really smart.
Yeah. I wouldn't be doing it.
But I think you'll be happy that you took the plunge either way. So.
No, I appreciate it. Are you buying or are you selling? That's what I used to always say.
Exactly. Yeah. So, well, look, for the lay people among us, can you describe what a manufacturing execution system, i.e. MES, is and how you make it more accessible to small and medium manufacturers?
Absolutely. I love this question because there's many definitions across many people, but so the official definition of a manufacturing execution system is defined within a spec called ISA 95, and it's the layers of technology within a factory. And MES is the fourth layer. The top layer is your enterprise resource planner, your ERP. So this is all your inventory and order management, the things that say go build these. The official definition of MES is layer 4, one below that, which is the command and control structure. So it takes those orders and it distributes them into the factory to be performed and carried out. And then it's the source of truth for a lot of the manufacturing information. So think of it as command and control. And then below that are the other layers, which are things like SCADA networks, if you're familiar with that. That's the machine-to-machine communication layer. There's HMIs, which are human-machine interface. So the visualization layer for people to drive machines. And then you eventually get down to the layer, which is sensors. I think that definition fits enterprise, very large manufacturers very well, where you have 30 technologies that they're brought to bear. I think it has near zero relevance to small and mid-sized factories, because one of the most difficult things to do when you have a small engineering team is integrate software sets together. Right? That's the real limit when it comes to small and mid-sized. It's not domain expertise. It's not knowledge about how to run a machine, or guide people, or pick tools, or whatever it might be. It's this limit of how many different things you have, you know, IT and OT resources to bring together. So we spin that definition of MES, and we combine layers 4, 3, 2, and 1 into a solution, because the factories that we support, right, these are still, you know, factories making hundreds of millions of dollars worth of revenue a year, but they tend to operate with two software sets. An enterprise resource planner, which does everything from order management, POs for more components, the ability to be source of truth of what was built and when it was shipped, even some of the logistics planning will come in that bundle. It's the accountant software by kind of its core fundamentals. And then we handle shop floor, because I believe like those are two separate teams and they need solutions that are specific for them. And so MES by our definition actually is from worker guidance all the way through to data collection and tool management into the command and control layer and the work order management side of the house as well. So any terms I used in there, Ken, that I could double click on, or did that resonate?
No, actually, I think it resonated well. I was an early stage employee at a little company called Wonderware way back when, yeah, a few decades ago.
Little company.
I can appreciate both sides of HMI, SCADA, and sensors as well. And hopefully our listeners can as well. Maybe we take a cut on this the other way, and let's talk about some of your outcomes. So what have been some of your more notable use cases and wins?
Yeah, so we at this point, even as a small company, we've deployed into dozens of other factories, and we have some really interesting ones. I'm a physical world kind of guy, so I like to think about the products that people make and then how they can make them better. I'll give an example of what I call bookends. So one of the smallest factories that we worked with started out with about 20 people in it. That's even below our normal size for people inside of it, but they were making lithium-ion battery packs initially for consumer products, but have a really interesting story of expansion into industrial, defense, and marine applications. But the win there is it doesn't really matter if you're making 1 or 1 million battery packs with lithium ion batteries in it. You have to have quality for every single one of them, or else bad things occur, right? Whether it's the fires we've seen or recalls, things like that. And so, how do you enable a shop with 20 people in it to be competitive in that area? And Lithos Energy is the name of the shop, they're based in the Bay Area. And they, I think, have done just a tremendous job. They're actually now, I would argue, a medium manufacturer through the scale they've achieved. And they achieved it because they were able to use a solution like Pico to completely error-proof their processes. So if you think about, like, you're bolting together a bus bar to a battery pack, you know, a high voltage joint, or even a low voltage joint is a current carrying joint. If that bolt isn't perfectly tightened, then you risk fire or failure, I should say. So how can a small factory use like a $1,500 DC nut runner, for example, without having to spend $50,000 worth of integrator time and effort to pay a consultant to set up that DC nut runner on their internet or intranet system, how to command and control it, communicate with it, et cetera? Well, in Pico, that's one of 150 different types of tools that are sitting in the library for you to grab with no software. So they're able to take advantage of that type of tool to perfectly error-proof their process so that their manufacturing engineering team isn't worried about training new people, managing labor as people change out, constantly doing visual checks or things like that. They instead are focused on, how do I run this factory more efficiently? How can I get to the next level of scale? Where are our bottlenecks, et cetera? And I think that's kind of one use case that is really exciting. But another use case is on the other end of the spectrum, you have a brand new factory, their name is Tritium. They make DC fast chargers. We're allowed to talk publicly about these too, which is nice. They are screaming forward with a factory to be able to produce the chargers that are in such high demand for the electric vehicle transition. And the faster you make them, the more of that, whether it's the IRA money from the government or these contracts from private companies, the more of that they can capture. And they've used Pico to completely build out that factory with multiple lines in months, not years. So they have a competitive advantage on a relatively complicated thing as they scale, because the software isn't holding them back. They're able to deploy a new station in minutes at this point. I think the first line took probably a month to roll out. And that in the MES world is just shockingly fast. To give a sense to listeners that may not be familiar with it, many times a factory rollout of a system that's doing command and control and connecting to torque tools and to people and to measuring systems and testers, that can take years and millions of dollars to roll out. And I think we've broken that paradigm and can show that you can do it in weeks and or months for tens of thousands or larger scale applications, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's really exciting to me anyway, as a manufacturing nerd, to see that capability present in the market.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And anybody who's lived through any kind of enterprise IT software deployment can appreciate how long and tedious that process can be. And so anything that would help, especially manufacturers, given some of the reshoring opportunities, or as you said, the energy transition opportunities, is very timely and very compelling. So Momenta has a general investment thesis of what I'll call industrial impact. And so we're always looking for not just the enabling technology and potential financial return, but also what's the end impact that company is having on the industries we know and love. And so I think it's interesting because you've got such a focus on U.S. manufacturing competitiveness, especially where we see a real opportunity in what I'll call the long tail of small to medium manufacturers. You've already mentioned some of the impact earlier, people centricity, reshoring, skilled trades, et cetera. But can you tell us a little bit about some of the impact that you see you're already making on U.S. manufacturing?
Yeah, I think there's stages of impact, which are what really excites me. And I'll kind of walk through a couple layers. The first impact, again, is on people's lives. Like, think about the operators in a factory and you're choosing between, you know, driving for Uber or Lyft or working at a restaurant, or do I go into this factory and assemble components all day long? Well, if that factory is like, follow Bob around and memorize Bob's, what he does for 2 weeks, and then do that over and over again. And by the way, never make a mistake. We need you to be absolutely perfect. Good luck. That's a pretty crappy job, frankly, in a lot of ways. And so with Pico in place in this kind of industrial impact, what we want to do is make performing work feel like the technology you use at home. I vehemently disagree, which is gets me in trouble from time to time, on the applications of AR and VR in many factories, because, you know, a light dance or camera display in front of an operator for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year is extremely annoying to that person. What we do instead is to impact their lives is have training data or videos or layered content on a screen right there when they need it. But most importantly, get out of their way and just let them do their job and instead be the backup. Be the person sitting behind them that's just making sure, like when your boss walks up, you know, and asks you if you filled out your healthcare, did you shoot all five of those bolts or did you shoot three of them? Well, with Pico, there's no anxiety about it, right? You don't ever have to worry about missing an action because it's error-proofed. So that's the first impact, is just this way of working. And I think the reason that matters on a macro scale is we have millions of open jobs in manufacturing that we need to fill. And we will not fill them if we just try to convince the world that we've been doing the same thing for 30 years and you should come inside. We need to give them a reason of why manufacturing is an exciting place. And this, it starts with the experiences around the technology and the facility that they can gain access to. And then the second impact is on the supply chain. Frankly, I appreciate the focus on new semiconductor fabrication facilities and electric vehicle battery plants and all of that. But if we don't have a supply base that can bring the machined extrusions with that are necessary to build a modern battery pack or the bus bars or wire harnesses or all of these other components that come in the supply chain, we will not be successful in our goals of reshoring manufacturing. Like, you can bring the major manufacturers back, but if you're still shipping all the parts from around the world because that's where the supply base is, you will have a difficult time being successful, in my humble opinion. And so that's the impact in the industry that we want to see, is these small manufacturers being hyper-efficient, moving from today's, you know, frankly, they operate at 40 to 50% efficiency today, measured by OEE or equivalent in the assembly area. And they need to be at 85% or higher. And frankly, my opinion is they should be able to run at 90% because they're specialists. They do tend to do less complicated things. You know, they build components, they're casting houses, they're extrusions. They're not building 17 different technologies. And our data is showing that we can get there. And we can get there quickly. We just need the adoptions to kind of be focused on. But I'll leave you with one more impact to ponder. I think the biggest thing that will happen between now and 2030 isn't artificial intelligence. I think AI is going to be really important to enterprise companies who have a digital backbone and can leverage the technology. But if you look at the industry as a whole, and a reminder, over half the output comes from mid-sized and small factories, not enterprise. The biggest impact will be a digital backbone on the supply base, enabling collaboration across the supply chain, because I believe that will open up efficiencies in not only logistics and component movements, but visibility. So part shortages can be dealt with when the tier four has the problem, not when it bubbles all the way up to the tier one and the OEM finds out they're going to be shut down, but also the collaboration that can eliminate things like the bullwhip effect. And if you're not familiar with the bullwhip effect, what happens is if General Motors changes its volume because they ran out of chips and they have to shut down for 2 weeks, well, the tier one already built the parts they were planning to ship to them. So now they have excess inventory. And then the one behind it, the one behind it, the one behind it all has this increasing amount of either inventory excess or not enough inventory as these ups and downs in the supply chain occur. And it costs millions and millions of dollars every year for factories in inventory carrying costs or inability to meet the demand when it goes the other direction and they didn't buy enough raw material. A lot of that can be solved by just showing inventory levels across the supply chain. I mean, very simple things that have massive impacts. And then you get into scope 3 emissions, which falls out of our data set. You can see things like circularity of scrap because we can certify the aluminum chips coming off the CNC machine are exactly this alloy and no other alloy. So they could go right back to the smelter instead of through generic recycling. Like, it all is founded on a digital backbone in the mid-sized world. And damn it, hell or high water, we're going to do something about it.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting on this because certainly, let's say AI, as is evidenced by, you know, ChatGPT's usage by, you know, I'll call it the average consumer now, has made AI much more relevant and accessible to the average person. And it's interesting because those same experiences are certainly being asked for in industrial settings, right? If I can ask ChatGPT for a good guacamole recipe, why can't I ask it for the best anodizing recipe for, you know, that I've been working on for years? And it comes back to exactly what you said. It's the lack of digital backbone or infrastructure that means you can't build those language models upon good, consistent, contextualized data sets. And so what we find is there is a bullwhip effect in some sense or kind of backlash that's coming back to companies like industrial data ops companies like, you know, Hibite we've invested in and Litmus and others. And what's happening is people are starting to pick these packages up so they can contextualize the data so they can now begin to perform some of the more advanced AI capabilities. So in my mind, there's a rising tide that certainly Pico MES will be helping to support and benefiting from. But it is going to be driven by these consumer experiences we're having, right? And wanting to have similar experiences in industrial settings.
Yeah, we have AI tools in our device library today where you can use AI on camera systems, for example. Mm-hmm. Our data structures are built for machine learning applications so that you can have non-intuitive gains be highlighted by things like that. And generative AI, I think, was going to be an even very significant impact in our tool set for being able to guide people to the right solution. So we have this like collection of known good solutions across factories, like, hey, this tool works really well and this one doesn't. And think about generative AI, ChatGPT style, that can guide you to, hey, check out this type of solution for this type of problem. So it will absolutely have an impact, but it cannot do so if there isn't some form of digital backbone to fall upon. And frankly, an ERP-only solution just isn't going to have the granularity of the data necessary for those technologies to be effective. So that's why I always remind folks, like, you can't ignore 54% of manufacturing, right, with technology. Mm-hmm. We need to solve the underlying impact first and then layer in all of these amazing tools that we've developed. I mean, I would argue you could look at what we do at Pico as take all of the enterprise tools that have been created and package them in a way that midsize can use them. And AI is going to be another one of those tools. But without that backbone, I don't think it can have the impact that we really want it to.
Yeah. Let me ask, how do you know when an organization is ready to adopt your solution? And probably even more so, what are some of the best practices you've seen in that organization realizing the potential value?
Yeah, so we call them catalyzing events. They tend to be the triggers that allow somebody to do something new, right? Our factories are existing for the most part. There's four of them that we have identified. I'll rattle them off, but the last one I think is the most important. You have a new factory, so like somebody is expanding and there's an opportunity to do something different, a chance to experiment with new technology. You have a new product launch, which is kind of like the same thing, except maybe only on one line in an existing factory, but you have the chance to build something slightly different. You have new leadership when there's someone else driving the ship and wants to see this kind of transformation, maybe brings with them technology they've used previously. But the most important one to us is actually a new requirement. And what I mean by that is, I'll use an automotive example, like one of the automotive OEMs out of Europe. If you are responsible for supplying a component to them that has a bolted joint in it, so screws or bolts fastening two pieces together, multiple pieces together, they require you to have measured torque and angle data for every one of those joints. So if they call you and say, hey, this part, bolt failed in the field, show me your data, you have to supply them with the actual torque and the actual angle measured. That requirement drove huge adoption of DC nut runners, the lower cost ones typically, but throughout that supply base just instantly. And that requirement is what I think tied to what is basically a champion inside of the factory are what we typically see really driving this growth. So I mention it because there's a little bit of responsibility from the enterprise side of the house too. If you really want to see some of these things we talked about in the connected supply chain, you know, taking the audit data rights that they already have today and making sure that they require, for instance, a transferable data solution, right, that can drive a huge chunk of adoption. And then on the mid-sized factories, it needs to be met with a champion inside of the world there that has a vision for where they want to go. And what's exciting to me is pretty much every factory has that, right? They have mid-sized factories are filled with these experts that just are incredibly impressive at how to run a machine shop or assemble electronics components or whatever their skill set might be. And they know what technology is out there. They just haven't had access to it. And so when you match a new requirement plus this champion's vision with Pico in between or an equivalent, I think you see the successes that you were referring to and kind of the potential value that could be realized.
You know, this has been a great conversation, and I can see several areas we could drill down on more, but alas, I think we're coming up on time. So in closing, I always like to ask, where do you find your personal inspiration?
Yeah, so for me, my family is who I look to for the majority of the kind of determination and grit required to keep a company moving forward. My parents have always been inspirational to me, and I was very fortunate to find a life partner in my wife that is significantly out of my league, both mentally and, you know, capability-wise. But outside of that, I think there are some interesting industry groups that allow for plant tours. Being able to go into another facility and see how somebody is operating their business is incredibly inspirational. And then I'm an avid reader and learner. I read a lot of industry articles. The NAM, National Association of Manufacturers Smartsheet, has a ton of really great articles in it. Assembly Magazine, Modern Machine Shop, and then podcasts. I mentioned I've been a longtime listener of Momentous podcasts, as well as the Made in the USA podcasts and some of the other technology podcasts. So I tend to have a kind of a shotgun blast of inspiration.
Well, thank you for the kind plug there. And I'd say that you certainly earned a place on our group of very esteemed speakers in there. And so glad we finally had a chance to catch up with you. So I really appreciate you sharing your time and insights with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a really fun conversation.
As well. So this has been Ryan Kuhlenbeck, co-founder and CEO of Pico MES. Thank you for listening, and please join us for the next episode of our Digital Thread podcast series. We wish you a momentous day. You've been listening to the Momenta Digital Thread podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed the discussion, and as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. Please check our website at momenta.one for archived versions of podcasts, as well as resources to help with your digital industry journey. Thank you for listening.